Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I've been thinking about fear a lot lately. I've been noticing how much tiny bits of fear run throughout my life, and I've been reflecting on the way in which confronting, engaging, even being sort of willing to deal with fear is a kind of an inevitable part of not just personal growth, but also political growth, because it's only when you can face certain fears that you're able to develop the strength to really engage the world in a more direct way. And I was particularly thinking about the way in which, you know, we realize that we have fears that are holding us back, that have traumatized us, things that have happened to us or things that we've experienced, and then we how do we deal with them? We don't want to actively live in that, and yet without facing, working through, processing, they still exist. And I've thought about in my own life how important nightmares have been for me, because nightmares are a sort of safe place to experience the most extreme kinds of fear, and to in some extent to be asked to deal with that trauma. You know, you wake up from a nightmare, your one impulse is to say, oh, well, that was just a dream, thank God, even though your like heart's racing, you're terrified, you've tasted a kind of terror that you've only seen in movies or something. But that's actually a marvelous opportunity to stay with those energies, to stay with those kind of fears. And I also think that's one of the more sort of sophisticated or nuanced reasons that people work with psychoactives. I was just watching a really wonderful talk, highly recommended talk that was at the last Breaking Convention by Manuel Villascusa, Villascusa, and it's on Vimeo. A very kind of contemporary, very smart shaman who works in Europe, and he was talking about the art therapy that they this group that's been meeting for years have used in order to kind of process their experiences. So it's a wonderful video on a lot of levels. But he was talking about the way that ayahuasca, particularly in its early stages, stirs up all this neurosis and all this fear, and really offers a place for one to sit in stillness with this material, because you can't always make it go away. And to develop the capacity to be in that discomfort, sometimes extreme discomfort of fears around death, around losing control of your body, around paranoia, around devils. There's all sorts of things that can come up. And I think that's one of the more healthy ways to respond to the difficulties of psychoactives, and in fact to even kind of take them. But this is all easy when it's just dreams or some crazy trip, but of course we have fears that go much deeper than that, and that's where things get really difficult, when fear is bound up with actual trauma and actual threat. And then hopefully these practices can come to a greater fruition. And so that's kind of part of our theme of the show today, but before we bring on our guest, who I'll introduce in a moment, I'd like to just bring on our co-host here, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hey, Eric, how's it going?
Pretty good. You got a little riff there on fear?
Yeah, man, it's the same thing I've been thinking about. I gave a talk last Sunday on occult techniques to deal with fear, and so much in agreement with so many of the things that you mentioned. And I one of the things I looked at was, it's true, right? You got like real things you should be afraid of, technically speaking, right? Like fire or a bus that's going to hit you, or like, you know, things to protect your meat suit from decapitation or whatever may fall, right? And then there's all the other category of fear is what's fascinating to me, right? Because you would think technically we would that fear really only should be those real, actual things that can hurt you, right? But then there is this whole kind of black cloud of miasma that develops, I think, as a result of the human race, which is all those fears, like you said, which are more like, you know, the deep, dark in the woods fear that the, you know, the psychedelic plants released, all those fears of what if, you know, what would happen if this, or all that unknown garbage that kind of floats around.
Yeah, so, and the way that those two things get very deeply intertwined is a most tricky matter, and I think that's a good way to introduce our guest, Lily Ross, who's getting her a degree in divinity at the Harvard Divinity School, and was introduced to me through a very good friend, and we had a wonderful afternoon talking about everything under the sun. And she's had some very intense experiences. You can talk about some, and we're going to use that to launch into some questions about consciousness culture, transformation culture, power, sex, the whole big shebang. So I'm really happy that Lily was willing and wanted to come on our show and tell us her story. Lily, welcome to Expanding Mind.
So much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice again. Where are you now?
Right now I'm on the fourth floor of Divinity Hall on the Harvard campus, and I'm looking out the window at massive snowflakes falling. It's quite the blizzard out there.
Yeah, you guys have had the craziest weather. I've never been to the Divinity School there at Harvard. Does it have a nice sort of sacred aesthetic feel, or does it feel like a university building?
It depends on where you are. I mean, beneath my feet right now is Emerson Chapel, and the building that I'm in right now is a couple hundred years old.
Wow.
And the corner of the campus that I'm in actually was sort of built as this holy trinity in the middle of the 19th century, where you have the Divinity School, and then you have the biological sciences, particularly the herbaria, and then you have the Peabody Museum, which has a number of pieces from different native cultures around the world. So it's supposed to be this God, nature, man kind of trinity nestled here in the kind of corner of the Harvard campus.
That's wonderful. Well, in a way, that's appropriate for your own story. It seems to have triangulated between these nodes as well. So take it away.
Yeah. You know, it's really amazing to hear these different perspectives on fear. And I think fear is one of those things that's really important to talk about, partially because we don't really like to talk about it, right? I've been reflecting a little bit lately. I was just writing this morning and yesterday in the book that I'm working on about this experience, how I drank ayahuasca about two nights before I left the Amazon, and one of the only vision from it I really remember was a moment when I saw my own corpse, and I was sitting there, I was watching the visions, and there it was right in front of me, and my face was, you know, my skin was gray, and it was all kind of sinking away from my face into the bone, and my eyes were totally empty, and I'd clearly been dead for some time. And I remember just kind of sitting there like, okay, that's interesting, a little scary. I'll stay here for a minute, you know, and just kind of sat with it until, you know, it seemed like it was appropriate to move on, and then moved on into the night. And, you know, 2 days later, I found out that the person with whom I had been staying is an alleged murderer, actually, of many, many people, and it became kind of a journey and an adventure of getting out of the Amazon as quickly as possible, knowing that my life might be at risk, and writing into and kind of reflecting on what it was like to basically be prey and to be in the hands of a predator who had laid a very, very skillful trap for me, using various spiritual techniques, various psychological techniques to really deeply ensnare me, exploit me, and just do some really horrific things.
This is super heavy stuff. Well, can you back up and sort of give us some context of what brought you to the Amazon, and how this heinous situation unfolded?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I went to the Amazon to do nonprofit work. I was working with an organization based in the United States, and I'd gotten a grant through Harvard to go on down there. I was going to be there for 9 weeks. And I had really been wanting to get myself to the Amazon for a really long time. I wasn't interested in going down to participate in shamanic journey kind of work. That did not compel me. But the person that I was going to do this nonprofit work with, and with whom my colleagues had been working for several years, was a very well-respected, shaman in the area. I mean, he's been featured on, you know, national television, national news for his work as a shaman who works with ayahuasca. So that was kind of a coincidental piece of it all. And the very short version of the story would be to say that that over the course of a very short period of time, through, you know, kind of sleep deprivation and changing my name and very clearly isolating me from the outside world, and then initiating this ongoing sexual relationship that was not something that I wanted, but not something that I felt able to say no to for a number of reasons. So that was really kind of the situation that I was in. And this lasted for about 25 days. And at the end of that, I was supposed to stay for several more weeks, and then right after that ayahuasca experience that I had had where I saw my own corpse, 2 days later I got an email notifying me that that this person was more dangerous than I could have possibly imagined, and I was on the run.
Yeah, you left your stuff and just saved yourself.
Yeah, I left everything behind. I left with the bag on my shoulder. Yeah.
That's just such a harrowing story. And I remember another detail you had told me before, which it seems important to bring up, that early in this process, it seems like most likely that he drugged you with Datura, which is, of course, a very delirium-inducing compound and is a very good tool for psychological confusion and what you could call re-imprinting.
Right, yeah. The word that's used down there for the plant is floripondio, and there are many, many different varieties of it with various purposes, ranging from treating tumors and other ailments to this kind of manipulation, suggestibility, this kind of thing. It contains scopolamine, so it's both a deliriant and a psychedelic, yes. And I do believe quite strongly that that on my second night in the village, I was dosed with this in an alcohol distillation that was applied to my entire body, almost my entire body. It took me months and months to put it together. I'd written the experience out, how, you know, I couldn't really walk. I was incredibly nauseous. It was a really harrowing experience. Meanwhile, this man who is my boss and my teacher and my host and my supervisor in this remote Amazonian region is making incredibly overt, powerful sexual advances on me and telling me all about how the spirits have said that this is, you know, what's supposed to happen and he's in love with me and, you know, all of these things. Things that, you know, if I had a dollar for every time I'd heard a man try and pull something like that, I'd have bought myself a real nice dinner by now. You know, but in the context of this incredibly powerful, deliriant kind of hallucinogenic state, it was incredibly, incredibly challenging to, it was impossible really to like physically fight back, you know, and in terms of the suggestibility that that it created.
Well, that's a part that I think is. There's a lot of aspects to this that are harrowing, but and also interesting in a kind of, you know, the horrible way that human beings can be interesting. But
right.
the way in which he was continuing to really be a shaman, in the sense that he was using his personal charisma. He was deploying, you know, psychoactives in an intentional way to produce certain effects. He was drawing from the realm of power, a realm of psychic power, and that we can't. It would be nice and easy to be able to say, oh, well, this is someone who's gone bad. He's not a real shaman. He's turning away from the truth or the essence of the tradition. And we instead to go like, well, this is actually kind of part of the picture in a way, in a scary way, because there are brujos, because there is a living tradition of this sort of dark side of shamanism. And okay. So it's a very confusing thing to try to, like, how have you come to think about the way in which above and beyond the manipulation, the control, the taking advantage of you when you were in a position where you had very little other recourse or no other recourse, that the way in which there was a quote-unquote spiritual or shamanic dimension to what he was doing, I mean, that must be a very weird thing to kind of take on and think your way through, as someone who's very sympathetic to these traditions and these practices, et cetera.
Absolutely, yeah, it's a very interesting question. One of the first things that comes to mind is an understanding that I got from one of my teachers, which is that a shaman is not somebody who is enlightened and, is all good and guru style. A shaman is a person who generally is in love with the sacred, right? And a lot of shamans will make mischief as readily as they will solve problems. It brings them business. These are very different cultural norms that we're talking about, very different societies that we're talking about. So that's kind of the first thing to get clear on. Another is that, again, from the same teacher, there's a difference between what he would call a sorcerer and a food, water, medicine man. So a sorcerer is somebody who's willing to manipulate reality to get the thing that they want. Right? And a food, water, medicine man is somebody who is interested in making life live and feeding things, feeding people, feeding the land. A food, water, medicine man knows that if they do something that is manipulative, if they do something to kind of change the course of fate, that they're going to be paying it back in ritual for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Because it's a really, really big deal to do so. And within, the Amazon and within this particular context with this particular person, we are talking about a sorcerer who's willing to go at all costs to produce the outcome that that he wants to see. And we are talking also about a very self-serving individual. I mean, he's human, you know. He's also a psychopath. But he's human.
And that's an important thing, I think, to bring up, because, yes, we can, like, separate these people that do atrocities and do horrible things from the rest of society, you know, which, you know, that creates a dilemma, too, because the reason the psychopath usually separates is because they see themselves as different, and so then they don't sympathize, right? They can't connect to people. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm just saying this happens, right? Then good people separate the psychopaths from them, too. So they do the same thing to the psychopath, which kind of like caused the problem to begin with. And I do agree with your description that you can break it down to those two types. But it's important to remember there's also the ones that do both. Like you said, there's people that will manipulate and feed. So then it becomes a little closer to reflect, like, human beings, right? None of us are really good or evil. But then we have the dilemma of these people that behave inappropriately and selfishly, right? So, like, for you, my question is, I mean, how did you resolve this issue with him? Like, did you try to press charges, or what was your method of kind of like reclaiming the inappropriateness of that? Did you just kind of continue to separate from it, or, I mean, how did you deal with it?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's a fascinating question. I, in terms of my own inner process, my first step was to get my feet back on the ground once I'd gotten away from him and get some stability
right.
back and self-soothe. Self-soothing was really, really key. And then once I had my feet on the ground, I really dove in headfirst, in terms of like recognizing that the sexual relationship had been so abusive and so painful and so violating. I couldn't even look at that until I had gotten my test results back and found out that I did not have HIV or hepatitis, which was a 3-month wait and three of the scariest months of my life. So, you know, there's pieces to the story like that.
Did you report him, like, to the authorities, or what happened there?
I mean, this is a person who has multiple allegations of murder against him, has warrants out, international arrest warrants out for him, but because of extradition treaties and things like that, has not been handed over to the authorities. In terms of any hope within the criminal justice system, for some kind of justice, I don't have any. That being said, I am making moves now to notify different international authorities as to what happened to me, largely because, you know, this is happening to other women and other people in different ways, and so it just feels important for my story to be on the record. For when
I think it's super important. And like you said, I mean, this is the thing with these sorcerers, right? They can, like, you felt totally powerless, and he basically was telling you to stay with him, correct? And you just did, right?
It was a lot more complicated than that.
Well, right. I don't mean to mitigate it, but I'm saying, like, that's how this stuff goes. Like, from every child molester to every, like, priest who does the same thing, you know, they prevent people from feeling like they have the power to say no or put up the boundary. And like you said, it's extremely complicated and goes very, very deep. I mean, think about how any, like, nations of people can remain enslaved. I think your story is very important because it shows a microcosm of that whole kind of consciousness and energy of how anyone can get oppressed by a dominator. You know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and there's a very insidious and ongoing process of grooming, preparing somebody, you know. The way that it's done, the simplest way I could say it is that you know, when it's executed by a master, and in my opinion, this man is a master, you know, by the time you think that you're making choices, you know, by the time it comes down to it, it's so subtle, it's so well done that you really just have no idea the kind of situation that you're in. I mean, you know, I'm trained in critical thinking at Harvard. I have a really strong value of intuition. I tend to be incredibly skilled at reading people. I have a really good track record with all of those kinds of things. And yet I found myself in this horrific situation that, frankly, I was very lucky to get out of alive. So it happens to anybody, it's masterfully executed to the point that it takes a lot of effort to tell the story in a way that that people can kind of understand, because we live in a victim-blaming culture anyway, right? But in these really insidious cases, it takes a lot of work to really suss it out and understand just how sick and twisted and perverse this is.
Well, I mean, that was one of the questions I had, is that you know, you in a number of different ways are carrying forward with this story. You're writing about it, you're talking about it, you're finding the appropriate way to tell it to authorities and sort of enter into the legal system. But, you know, right next door, the legal system is like your life and your emotions and people and culture and this much larger amorphous field, which is really, in a way, the place that you're going to have to end up dealing with it, whatever happens with the justice system is in some sense apart from the story that you have to tell in order to heal yourself and make meaning of this process. And I'm curious, as you've gone out and told the story in different ways, different contexts, what have you learned about our culture and our capacity to hear and acknowledge and register stories like yours?
Well, you know, recently I've been talking about the story publicly, and for the most part, actually really entirely, most people are coming to me and they're saying, this is this is helpful. I relate to this, you know. I don't have people, once they know enough of the story and my reflections on it, nobody comes up to me and says, I think you're full of shit and I don't know what you're talking about, you know. People really kind of get this, which is really, 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 really interesting. And then, you know, there have been other conversations that have been very different. I remember just a few months after I'd gotten back from the Amazon, I took a phone call with an old friend of mine, somebody that I respected and admired and appreciated very, very much. And I told him about what had happened, and he stopped me, and he said, you are scaring me so much right now, because the way you're telling this story, you are inhabiting victim consciousness, and you're giving all of your power away.
Hmm.
You know? And I said, dude, brah, I was a victim,
yeah.
You know? Victimhood is not an eternal identity, right? It's something that we can say in a particular time, in a particular place, I was victimized by these circumstances. And then he starts giving me this whole, well, you create your own reality, and you were complicit in creating and co-creating this experience so that you could learn and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I just said, you know, if you really believe you create your own reality, there's no room for God. There's no room for the other. You're completely and entirely asserting control over your own life and complete agency. And that's just not the way the world works. We talked about this for quite a while, and he really was very resistant to it. I finally said to him, I can promise you a few things in this life, but I promise you this. One day the person closest to you will die, and you will feel powerless because you will be powerless. You know, I think that's one of the places that people get really caught up and really afraid. People don't know how to relate to power. They don't know how to necessarily relate to our own power. We don't have models or teachings really around that kind of stuff. And so this idea that one can be made powerless by circumstances or by another human being, I think is deeply, deeply unsettling for people.
Yeah, especially in our culture, it's really been interesting to hear you talk about that particular problem, because that's a big deal. You know, there's a lot of people in the spiritual world, transformational cultural world, New Age, whatever, who at some level adopt this notion about creating your own reality, and it can be a more complicated idea than simply, well, you just choose everything that happens to you. But it's got a pretty good hold, and it's unfortunate the way that people don't really think through it, not only in terms of the problem of then you end up blaming the victim, but this deeper point that you're making, which I think is really beautifully put, that there's no room for anything else. For anything else in your own little, you know, reality creation machine. There's no other, there's no God, there's no natural forces, there's no chance, there's no, you know, there's all this stuff is evacuated by this self, you know, whether it's your ego or your higher self or whatever, it almost doesn't matter. And that seems so reflective of our particular culture's need for an idea of control. You know, that we're actually there. That's where we want to be. We want to be master. We want to be in cause, as they say in some of the New Age self-help groups. And it isn't the case. And, you know, it's like stories like yours just don't work in that world. And so it's I think it's very illuminating, that particular exchange, I think, is a very illuminating one, as is your response. Mm.
It was a very fascinating conversation, and the way I relay it now, I probably sound strong. In the moment, it was one of the most harrowing conversations I've ever had. I mean, I was shaking. I was near tears, because this person that I cared about was basically telling me all of the reasons why what had happened to me was my fault and how I needed to reclaim my power. Which was just excruciating. And he even went so far as to posit at one point that this person who, you know, repeatedly, forced himself upon me sexually, had my own best interest at heart, and had done this to me because he knew that I would do something beautiful and powerful with it, and it was part of a larger kind of gestalt that was ultimately healing. I mean, whoa, you know?
Yeah, that's a rough ride. Well, this is a fascinating conversation. We got more to say, and we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau. We're talking with Lily Ross, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're speaking about all the terrible things that people do to each other and how to deal with them in real life. We're speaking with Lily Ross, and before the break, you guys have been talking a lot about that kind of power-tripping thing in New Agers, and Eric, I do believe that everything you said in that respect was true, but I think it's important to point out that there are many, many areas and levels of, you know, people who consider themselves New Agers, and I think a lot of these cult of the selfie people, you can't just put a blanket on all, like, the New Age movement, because even in the New Age material, there's a bunch of people that are all, like, about self-sacrifice and helping others, and that whole light movement is, like, a real thing as well. So I think it's important.
I just want to clarify. Yeah. It's just that it's a widespread idea in that world.
Sure.
I'm not saying that everybody in it subscribes to it.
Totally, and I totally don't think you did say that, but I want everyone to understand that distinction so that they don't just think New Ager and they think selfish, psychopathic, weirdo shaman, right? So it's like, but it is important to look for and recognize these behaviors that people have, like you said. So, you know, you, it seems like, have this reached this point where you didn't get much satisfaction in the justice system. You had to deal with this all, like, emotionally yourself. You had to go through the victim, like, thing because you had these events happen to you. So then I always look at, like, with a lot of my clients that have been through trauma, what do you do now, right? Then you're left with this, like, how do you deal with the fear? How do you reintegrate trust? Like, how do you not become, you know, broken as a result of these people? So we were talking about power before. You mentioned how people do have these weird things with power. And, Eric, I think, like you said, all those folks that get, they have a description for it, right? They call it the God complex, the Messiah complex. When someone gets some of this, like, spiritual information and they go cuckoo and they think everything is about them, right? That's, like, they call that the root chakra response, which I think is all those New Agers that behave in that manner are having, like, they're just having to deal with that issue. So for folks like you that are on the receiving end of that inappropriate behavior, it's like, how do you, I want to know if you've found methods or ways that you've been able to kind of, like, I know you said you put your feet back on the ground, but how do you manage to continue to, like, not let that poison you or, you know, become your identity or keep that, you know, kind of fear and experience away from yourself?
Mm. Great questions. One of the first things I want to say is about a month after I got back, I came up with the phrase that medicine misused is poison, and poison well used is medicine.
Mm.
Right? Jumping back in time a little bit in terms of this particular narrative, you know, there was a moment when I was staring into this person's eyes. I had just told the lie that would ultimately enable me to escape, and he was doing this, like, sociopathic stare down assertion of dominance thing on me, and I was completely, you know, falling apart in some ways in that moment. But in that moment, I also chose life, and really, it's a strange thing, but it took me 25 years on this planet to get to a point where I realized, you know what, I want to be alive, and I'm willing to fight for it, and I'm willing to work for it, and I'm going to have to do that right now, so I'm going to do that right now, you know, and letting that just kick into gear. And really, I think that was fundamentally something that would carry me through months of tears and of trauma and of sleepless nights and panic attacks and just, you know, harrowing moments in kind of processing through this was that I had fundamentally chosen to live, and as I began to approach the healing process, I made a decision that I was going to exploit this this opportunity, this experience, to learn as much as I possibly could about myself and about the world, so that I might one day be able to use the story as a teaching story, and really kind of share from that place. But really choosing life was really, really, really key.
So you found your free will, right? That's what they call it, right? When you, because that's the evil shaman guy represents, theoretically or symbolically, any influence that could cause us to do something we're not in accord with, or, you know, whether it's drugs or people or any of those influences that do have that power to oppress us or take us over. In that moment, when you discover your free will, when you choose life, I mean, that's when you became free. That's beautiful.
It was a very powerful moment to me, and my hope is that if I can, you know, share it with other people within the context of my story, that it won't take those kinds of circumstances to for them, you know, because it does seem to take something pretty extreme, at least in other people that I've talked to that maybe have had to, you know, talk about making that choice at different points in their lives. But he really, very successfully, this man, interrupted my intuition and interrupted my sense of free will. And the way that I kind of talk about it now is to say that my own inner voice was commandeered from me, particularly after the night when I believe that I was dosed with the floripondio, with this powerful dissociative plant. You know, I had a really, I couldn't even trust my own inner voice anymore. Especially in retrospect, when I looked at some of the things that were going on in my internal world that just felt so out of place. I was a stranger to myself, you know, which is just so bizarre. And such a deep part of the healing process was being willing to just get over self-doubt, you know. I mean, get over. I mean, it has its place, of course, but to really just
cannot let it stop you from acting, though, really is the thing, because that's where self-doubt becomes that paralysis by analysis, right? It's like I said, that's the thinking fears that show up, and then the danger is that they would stop you from acting, right? Like, if you hadn't come to that place, you might have just not done anything, not for any fault of yours, but for the simple fact that it wouldn't arise.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of acting in the world, it is definitely important. In terms of how I get through the day every single day, you know, I like to say that each of us has a choice in how we relate to and tell the stories of our lives, you know, and that's not necessarily telling those stories to other people. It's telling those stories to ourselves. You know, my thesis here really kind of delves into this idea that we create our identity and ourselves through the stories that we tell about ourselves, about our lives. And so it has a lot to do with the inner narrative and what I believe for myself to be true. If I fundamentally am doubting myself, then I cannot create a cohesive and self-empowering narrative to just even be able to relate to myself in a productive and healthy way on a daily basis. So it's much more intimate and personal, and then, of course, extends out into the ability to speak and to take action and those kinds of things.
So here's a question. I hope this isn't too abstract, but, you know, I'm still resonating with the way you talked about our need to make room in our model of reality and our experience of the world for others, for other people, for nature, for God, for, mm-hmm. you know, that we're not always in control, that we have to let room be there for these forces. And then at the same time, we're talking about the need for inner narratives that are not hamstrung by self-doubt, that are not so overwhelmingly self-critical that they're not able to merge it, that allow and authorize a certain kind of power.
Right.
How do we bring those things together? How do you make room for a self-empowered position, especially in response to a very challenging situation that took away your power, and still, whatever, keep that tenderness, keep that openness, keep that willingness to not be in control, to not know? How are you wrestling with that?
You know, the word that pops into my head as I hear you say this, Eric, is learning. You know, learning, learning, learning. I like to think of learning as kind of an ongoing process of constructing knowledge about the world and constructing this, you know, ever-changing stories about ourselves, and also a practice and exercise in receptivity. You know, when we learn something new, we really have to kind of get into the scaffolding of ourselves, our identities, our lives, our cosmovision, really, and see the ways in which what we are learning interfaces with that, and does it challenge it? Does it fundamentally disrupt it? Does it complement it? Maybe it does both of those things at the same time, you know? One of the things I've learned through this experience is that one must cultivate a tolerance for uncertainty, for not knowing, and for simultaneous contradictory truths, right? And it's a lot to hold, and it takes, I think, a lot of focused energy to really cultivate the capacity to have a sense of authority in terms of one's own inner narrative and to continue to practice being receptive and listening, which is just, you know, one of the trends I see a lot in America and in different subcultures is the trend of narcissism. And I think a willingness to learn, and a willingness to learn from others, in contrast to the story that we, everything that we see is a reflection of ourselves and this kind of very grand idea. I just lost my train of thought. But it's...
Well, I mean, I'm just, because I know we had talked about this before, and again, I was very interested in your comments about some of the narcissism you see, you know, particularly in let's call it transformational culture and the sort of, you know, the world of people who are really interested in supposedly in changing themselves and in growing into spirit and in integrating with nature, with the forces that are out there in this kind of, in a youth context, in many cases, and you know, it's a world that takes, you know, shamanism very seriously as a route towards towards balance and aliveness. And yet, I was really touched by some of the things that you said about the problem of narcissism, how easy it is to not pay attention to that potential within oneself, within one's culture, within one's dominant narrative. So I'd love to hear you flesh that out a little bit.
Well, the first thing I'll say is that I find narcissism to be boring in the experience of it. I think conceptually it's fascinating, but there's this really interesting thing with narcissism. So there's people that have narcissistic personality disorder, right? There's people that have narcissistic traits, and then there's a thing called acquired situational narcissism. Right. So if a person is in an atmosphere that's really encouraging these kind of narcissistic tendencies, one can kind of pick up and begin to exhibit characteristics of narcissism, and then those will usually dissolve when the person exits that particular situation. I think that this is really, really interesting because I've stepped into a lot of, you know, festivals maybe on the West Coast and things like that. And I hear a lot of people, you know, using this terminology of, you know, everything in the world is a reflection of me, and people do a lot of work around kind of reclaiming projections and all this kind of stuff. And like that can be totally fruitful and totally real and totally interesting. It can also be taken way, way, way too far, right? And there, in terms of my own experiences, moments where I feel like I can say I've kind of stepped into this kind of acquired situational narcissism where it does become all about me, 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 it's exceptionally boring and uninteresting. I mean, it just becomes this so totally minutia-focused, self-centered place that is just so, so much less rich in meaning and depth. Then,
well, again, so here, I mean, this is really important, I feel like, what you're saying with the narcissist, because it's a little similar to the sociopath and psychopath, although it's certainly like the right, the top level of surface, and then it gets deeper as we go into psychopathology. This is an important thing that you're talking about here, because
like I said in the beginning, these are people, they're, when it's all about you right now, you're separating. In the New Age movement, the opposition of what you're talking about is the idea that everything is connected. And then it's not just about me, but the idea that everything is a reflection of you. It's not you, you, but like the we, the us, right? So how do we then, what do you think do we do with these like narcissists and the psychopaths, right? Like can we heal that behavior? Like, people are saying all this stuff, right? And you witnessed all those things and experienced that there are individuals who are kind of propagating this idea. So what do we do about this? Like, what's the antidote to, like, is that just it? Like, are they done? That's it. Once people get to that point, it's kablooey, or what do we do?
Well, first thing that comes to my mind is that it is never our responsibility to heal other people. You know, I mean, it's impossible. And when we're talking about some of these really powerful personality disorders, one is incredibly limited in what kind of help that they can provide if they're not a very trained and very skilled and very knowledgeable professional. So what I think is important as a community is to have a language for it, have names for these things, cultivate understanding so that we can talk about this. You know, if we can talk about it, then we can see it clearly and we can make choices about how we want to relate to it. If it's completely in silence, if we don't have a language for it, then there really is no agency and there's nothing that can be done. You know, I think it's just really important to be able to say, wow, this person is showing up in these ways, and it's really not my stuff, and it's not my problem. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of a boundary thing, I think. And boundaries are not necessarily, I've noticed trends at times where boundaries are really not necessarily the most respected or important things in a lot of these subculture communities, which I find very disconcerting, you know. Which leads me also to this piece about the ego. So people talk a lot about, you know, they want to transcend the ego. Moving to transcend the ego before the ego is fully formed and intact as an adult human ego is part of what really lends itself to these kinds of narcissistic behaviors and things like that, because you're trying to dissolve a child ego structure. Most people have not had the proper support and development to move beyond a child ego structure, in my opinion, right? And we see this in the absence of, say, initiatory, you know, opportunities for people to become initiated adults, if this makes sense.
Well, what do you think is a way to cultivate that aspect of the situation? I think a lot of these problems, it's no accident you find them in youth cultures or cultures that are dominated by young people, because there's this absence in our society that other societies had in various ways, some of them more, you know, traumatic than others. But nonetheless, there was this notion of a real passage into a different kind of being with different sets of responsibilities, different kind of power that was in some sense given to you and in some sense something you had to claim. And I think, you know, with in the West, there's such an absence there. It's very confusing for people. And so that what you get is a lot of sort of this retarded, not idiotic retarded, but just, you know, held back maturation process. At the same time, these are incredibly creative scenes. There's lots of people with tremendous, you know, vibrancy and music and dance and love and stories and narratives and images. And it's a very rich place. What is there? Is how to help create a cultural process,
right,
that adds that kind of maturity in a way that's different than just, you know, dropping out of the scene or saying, oh, I'm done with this now, I'm on to other things.
It's a really, really interesting question, and I'm having thoughts about it that I've never quite had before. One of them is that in order to achieve some kind of initiated adulthood, you have to want it. And by that I mean that, you know, I may be totally incorrect with this, but the sense that I get is that in cultures where there are rites of passage and initiatory things, becoming an adult is something that is revered and respected and honored in a way by the society. And we have a lot of different narratives in America, for instance, about adulthood and what that is and what that looks like. Now, within some of these subculture communities, we have a lot of people talking about initiation and particularly in the context of Joseph Campbell's appropriation of Arnold van Gennep's rights to passage, where he kind of, it was van Gennep who really put forward this idea of separation, initiation, return, although he used other words for it. And people have really kind of taken that and they've said, okay, this is about the hero narrative. You know, this is about becoming a hero and becoming a hero in our own lives and all this kind of stuff. And then the other initiation story that's really common, popular, powerful is the I'm becoming initiated as a shaman, you know. So a bunch of people are running around trying to become heroes and trying to become shamans. And so for me, in terms of a solution, I tend to work on the level of language, again, believing that both as individuals and as a society, the stories that we tell and the linguistic map that we have for the world really frames how it is that we interact with reality, right? So from that place to then change the languaging and change the conversation and say, you know, is it really about becoming shamans? Yeah, is it really about becoming heroes? Or is this just about becoming adults and claiming responsibility and claiming accountability and claiming a role, a meaningful role in a community where that is appreciated and welcomed and viewed as important, you know?
Yeah, it's I love everything you're saying. It's really resonant. And it's funny, though, because as soon as you say the word adult, I'm like, I'm a little over the hill here, I still go, oh my God, adult, I don't want to be one of those. And, you know, there's this absence of a figure, maybe a romantic figure of the mature adult that is part of the problem, that the hero is the adventurer. It goes out into, you know, and in a way the shaman narrative is very similar. The shaman's the one who goes out into the crazy world and then comes back with something and you know, hopefully, you know, supports, I mean, the community. I mean, it was to say within the shamanic metaphor, though, this is a very, a contradiction that has definitely not been taken on by the community, is the way in which, you know, shamanism traditionally is always embedded in very specific healing situations, or, you know, not always, but largely in its positive format. And people come to it today with this desire for some experience, for some vision, sometimes with specific issues, but the whole question of identifying what needs to be healed, I think, is a place where there's a lot more work to be done. That it's not just your sense of spiritual wanderlust or some kind of missing meaning in your life or some need for enchantment in our supposedly disenchanted world. There's much more specific ways to bring much more specific issues to those sort of, you know, healing modalities. And maybe that's one way that you develop a more mature relationship to these processes.
Well, dude, it's totally true, and that's where the responsibility has to come in, okay? Let's say all these people are becoming shamans, right? Let's say that's true. A shaman becomes powerful for one reason and one reason only, and that's to help everybody else. So it's like these hero stories that you're talking about, like that you mentioned. They want to become the superhero, they want to become the Superman, but then they just want to, like, live in their crystal castle and not come help everyone when they're in trouble. Like, they're not finishing the story. They're not, you know, developing into adulthood. Like you said, like, they have to mature that idea of the superhero to include the fact that any reason you would be good at anything would be only to help, you know, humanity get more awesome. But that part is getting left out.
Right. Right.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes here, and we didn't talk about nomad culture and some of the other stuff that you're doing, so I wanted to let you have a moment here where you could tell some folks what you're up to.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. My dear friend Evan Bartholomew, who also has the alias Blue Tech as a musician, he and I have co-founded an online magazine called nomadculture.net, which is really kind of at the intersection of art and activism and intellectual work that really showcasing it and really focusing on people that are sort of bringing those worlds together in interesting and creative ways. So that's kind of the big thing creatively. And then I'm getting ready to graduate here at school and kind of move on into the next phase, and putting a lot of thought into developing sort of a practice, being able to support people in integrating psychedelic experiences, particularly. I'm really approaching it from a learning-oriented perspective. So I think, you know, these are tools and medicines, and you know, these materials are all kinds of things, and they offer us great teachings. And we have to really work to learn from those teachings and to bring them into our lives in meaningful ways, which comes back to the responsibility piece. There's a lot of people offering a lot of shamanic services and psychedelic services around the world that where there's really not follow-up or, you know, anything like that. So, of course, I won't be offering anybody any kind of medicine or anything, but working to really support people and chewing on what it is they are fed through these experiences.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, best of luck with all that, Lily. And thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. Well, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.